Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kovacar. I have the pleasure of being back behind the mic again to host an episode with my lovely friends here, Aaron Wang and Tegan Marshall. And today I have a pretty interesting discussion to bring to you too, and something that I think would be a really interesting thing to hear your thoughts on. As I might have mentioned in previous episodes, I am a student at the University of British Columbia in the Okanagan. Recently, there was a philosophy talk that was put on by the PPE, Philosophy, Political Science, and Economics Department at UBCO, and they brought in someone by the name of Jeremy Reed to discuss a subject called Aristotelian Prohibitions. Now, I think immediately to anyone who has some background knowledge about ethics, that may sound like an interesting title because Aristotle makes you think of virtue ethics. Prohibitions makes you think of something more like Kant, deontology. Jeremy Reed proposes that there is somehow a connection that can be drawn there between absolute prohibitions, virtue ethics, in a way that can make it more integrate absolute prohibitions into virtue ethics for the benefit of virtuous actors. Now, before I get into that, just a little bit about Jeremy Reed, if you're interested in looking him up or checking his work out. He is an assistant professor in philosophy at San Francisco State University. He was a postdoctoral research associate at the University of Maryland, College Park, and completed his PhD in philosophy at the University of Arizona. He grew up in Auckland, New Zealand, and he has undergraduate studies in philosophy, musicology, and the classical languages. So a lot of his work has to do with Greek and Roman philosophy and ethics and contemporary virtue ethics. So just a little bit of credit to the author of this particular idea. So let's jump into this right away then. So I have here the lecture notes that we got from the talk, and I'm just going to run through them briefly and give you the idea of what's going on. For a bit of background, let's go to some standard virtue ethical claims. That's where he started. So when we're talking about virtue ethics, just as a reminder for our listeners, we're talking about a ethical theory that basically says to be a good person, to be an ethical person, you have to have a certain set of virtues or characteristics. You have to act in the right way, think the right thing, and feel the right way about it. And this was Aristotle's contribution to sort of ethical theory as we have it today. As you can imagine, the idea of being ethical or virtuous by this theory is having those characteristics. Now, people disagree as to what those characteristics are, if there is a finite list or not. Can you make mistakes and still be virtuous? All of these are questions that have to do with virtue ethics, but not ones we're going to tackle today. So the way Jeremy Reed phrased it, he said, so some standard virtue ethical claims are, first of all, the practically wise agent perceives what they should do in light of the particulars of their current circumstances. So obviously you're faced with a situation, you have to decide what's the best way to act. Well, a virtuous actor takes that into consideration and does what they should, often in line with the golden mean. It's something we've talked about before on the show, I think, but it's the idea that you act somewhere between excess, too much of something, and deficiency, too little of something. So if you get, for example, bravery, courage is a virtue, according to Aristotle, but if you're too courageous, you can be sort of foolhardy and run headfirst into dangers that are unnecessary. And if you're deficient in courage, you're cowardly. Right? And neither of those things are good. And there's somewhere a good in between. And the other thing that he put into the background of this is that rules, any rules that virtuous actors follow, they're for the most part rules or rules of thumb. They're kind of like training wheels as you develop in virtue. So someone, your parents, for example, in educating you in how to be a good person might give you some rules of thumb, like you should say certain things to people, or you should, you know, act in a certain way for people. But as you learn and you gain experience, you learn that, you know, maybe some situations you don't have to so strictly follow those rules. Like, generally speaking, hold the door for someone, but if they're 2 miles away down the road, you can probably safely enter the building and you're not being impolite. You know, simple things like that. He gives the analogy of, like, baking cookies, for example. You take the cookies out of the oven when they're done, not when the timer goes off, just because you know that they should be baked for 15 minutes. I mean, you kind of judge it by experience. His analysis is basically what he's saying about these rules is that, quote, just because rule following is not sufficient for characterizing the agency of the virtuous agent doesn't mean that rule following is not necessary. Following rules doesn't make you virtuous, it's not sufficient, doesn't mean that rule following doesn't play an important part of being a virtuous person. And this is pretty different from what you usually get in virtue ethics. Usually you get this idea that to be a virtuous person, you have to have those characteristics. And it doesn't really talk at all about rules. So that's where we get into the discussion today, because he is basically trying to integrate a kind of absolute prohibition into virtue ethics. Now, I'll just summarize what an absolute prohibition is, and then I'll pass it off to my co-host here to give their thoughts. So, absolute prohibitions you can think about as something that someone should never do, right? There are kind of two schools that really talk about this. Kantian deontologists, so people that think that ethical laws are sort of laws of that are rationally discoverable, and they're sort of part of nature, and, so in that case, Kant says, thou shalt not steal, right? Like, there's never a situation in which you should steal, or you shouldn't kill, or you shouldn't, that kind of thing. There are some absolute rules, that prohibitions that you have to follow. And so Kant, of course, you know, he was the one that came with the idea that you can kind of find ethical rules just by using your reason, your logic. You can discover some ethical rules, and those include the prohibitions, the things that you never do. Of course, lying is the example. Other natural law theorists, they're called, they kind of take it in a religious perspective. They say that if you have some God-given rules, like a Christian doctrine, for example, a theology, the example given by Reed is Finnis, the philosopher Finnis, who talked about this relation between sort of Christian tradition and ethics. So you have some rules given by the Christian faith, and it's not that we have to understand when those rules are applicable, or that, you know, if it's written on the, if one of the commandments is that, you know, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, it's not that you get to choose in every situation, do I follow this rule or not? Even if you don't understand why the rule is there, or even if it seems to be producing more harm in the world than good, you follow that rule. You don't break that prohibition, because it's absolute. That's the idea. And so to tie these two things together, Jeremy Reed is basically suggesting that you can integrate absolute prohibitions, these commandments, into Aristotle's virtue ethics. And there's a couple strategies that he uses to do that. But before I get into those, I want to turn it to my co-host here for some initial thoughts. What do you think? What impression does it give you to be virtuous according to Aristotle, and do you think that that makes sense, that virtuous actors would have some kind of absolute rules imposed on them?
Aristotle has already stated on his more spectrum that he uses to devise the golden mean, he's already said, don't be overzealous. That is dangerous. Don't be so concerned with self-preservation that you don't act. So he's already set two extremes. I think the absolute prohibition, however, says something more specific, that this is the line, this is what that line looks like. If you cross that, that's a problem. So I definitely see foundationally an aspect of that. I think there's more conversation that needs to be had, and that's why we're having this show, to kind of flesh out what that looks like. Because given someone's reading of Aristotelian ethics, given someone's situational experience, cultural background, all those kind of things, that hard line is going to be hard to distinguish.
And I think from the philosophical perspective, I can understand why someone might say that rule following is not enough to ascribe virtue to someone. Because you can certainly see that if someone doesn't follow the rules, then they're not perhaps a good person. But to say that someone is essentially the best sort of person, the virtuous person, that means that they're essentially choosing the right thing to do or what is good in whatever situation you're talking about. I think that's the moral ideal that we consider when we talk about ethics. And so that ideal might not be required from every set of rules. It might be something that is incumbent on the individual to understand certain contexts and certain particulars that are beyond the scope of whatever authority is in charge, who might not be able to take into account every situation. So I can certainly see why rule following by itself wouldn't be the perfect solution.
For sure. No, I think you both are taking this in the perfect direction for continuing this conversation. I appreciate those thoughts. And I think they're in line with what Jeremy Reed was thinking. And because he very much took a sort of, in my interpretation now, full disclosure, I think that he took a very sort of relativistic approach to this, where it very much is about the circumstances, right? Where maybe absolute prohibitions, as they're stated by Kant or by Finnis, don't work immediately with the virtuous actor, because you think, wait, there's some aspect of like what in there's some aspect in which a virtuous actor takes each situation individually and says, okay, what can I do to be virtuous here, even if it's not what the rule says, right? So there seems to be a sort of disconnect there. So he gives three strategies of how a virtuous actor can apply absolute prohibitions, two of which he is not so convinced about, and one of which he thinks is the best option. So I'll start with those, and we'll see where we go from there. The first strategy that he offers is what he calls analytically vicious actions. And this goes to what Tegan was saying, because Aristotle actually said, even beyond the golden mean, that there are some actions that people just, you can't do well, you can't do right, because they're wrong in and of themselves. They're vicious, as it suggests, and as the name suggests, analytically, sort of by reason. So, for example, he talks about adultery or cheating, right? You can't cheat with the right person on the right day at the right time for the right reason. Like, you just, you can't. There's something about, you know, betraying your loved one that is vicious on the face of it, right? That there's just nothing, there's no way that you can do that in a golden mean kind of way. And so in that sense, you can talk about actions that are always vicious just by their nature. Some of you may know Rosalind Hursthouse as a philosopher, name in philosophy, and she basically said such actions cannot form part of a well-spent day. Like, there's no ways in which you can do that correctly. The problem is that, you know, you may disagree on what constitutes how to describe those actions. And the example there is self-defense, for example. Like, you say that killing someone is wrong. There is a situation such as self-defense in which it's permissible. Or maybe adultery, like if you didn't know that they were married, are you really at fault? And so, but basically what Jeremy argues is that it doesn't matter if we could disagree about how to describe something. It's just and finding that description is our sort of responsibility in order to discover these actions that are vicious on the face of it. So that's one way you could go about it.
Yeah, I think it's important just what you're describing, Mihai, in terms of knowledge, in terms of motivation, right? What we're getting at in terms of the pursuit of virtue is intention. The purpose of virtue ethics, in my understanding, and perhaps my colleagues disagree with me on this point, I doubt it, is that to pursue virtue is to actively pursue that, right? So something like mandating rules and prescribing solutions, that doesn't necessarily drive you towards virtue. That actually to bring it to Socrates, which was the precursor to Plato and Aristotle, right? He talks about in the Theaetetus, he speaks of, and the Republic as well. He speaks to when we are not actively thinking and perceiving and striving to know what is virtuous, the rational part of our souls, which for the Greeks is psyche, the rational part of the mind falls asleep. And so we become more a slave to our desires and our passions. And I think that's the person who desires to know virtue must actively participate in it, right? And I think that's the trick when we're talking about something like this, is that virtue is something that is sought after, something that is pursued, not something that can be enforced upon somebody else.
Just to push back a little bit, because you used the example of cheating earlier, and everyone has seen the Hallmark movie examples where, you know, person A is seen with person B, and then they take that to mean that person A is cheating with person B, and then so romantic interest person C decides to break up with person A, but then it was a misunderstanding. Even when we have hardline rules where, you know, where we say this is specifically wrong, do we have a specific definition of what that thing is in every context?
Yeah.
And that's,
no, that's exactly
where we have kind of cultural interpretation. And you could say, like, from the moral relativist position, especially a cultural interpretation and potential differences. I think if you were going to take a moral absolute position, then you would have to basically say, well, you know, we have a universal example of cheating, and then we're like, this is for sure too far. We kind of draw a line in the sand, and then everything else is kind of approximate. It's gray area, but it doesn't count. And I think that's essentially why this model can work quite well, is because it says, okay, well, we have absolute prohibitions, so this person couldn't be considered what we would consider a bad person, but we won't consider them necessarily a good person either, just because they follow the rules that, you know, they're technically not cheating. That doesn't mean it's that they're technically faithful or they're technically the loving partner that you're looking for. So figuring out where kind of those boundaries lie, and yeah. I'm never going to give any romantic advice ever, but just because that's not what the show is about. But you can see very clearly that ethically speaking, it's a very different thing to say, well, you know, this person is wrong because they did this thing, and this person is the good person that I am looking for.
The Canadian philosophy dating show. No, I think those are some really good points. I have two main gripes with this model, one of which is the epistemological concerns behind virtue ethics as a whole, and second of all is this disconnect. This goes to what Tegan was saying, this disconnect between an actor's intentions or their actions and their relationship to virtue. But we'll get back to that in just a moment. I want to also bring onto the table the second strategy and then show you sort of how he gets to the conclusion of what an Aristotelian prohibition is, because I don't think I've fully described that just yet. So another way you can think about this is absolute prohibitions secure, in a sense, a human good. So what Jeremy said in the lecture was that some goods, this is quoted from his notes, some goods might be necessary for or partly constitutive of our flourishing and happiness, as in eudaimonia. Absolute prohibitions could be useful or necessary for securing those goods for animals like us, either because if anyone breaks the rule, the good is lost, like if you deface a piece of art, for example, or the good is better secured or better achieved if everyone follows the rule, like if you have a prohibition against assault to secure our bodily integrity, that's a better way of achieving that goal of bodily integrity than if there was no rule against assault. Does that make sense? So it's like there are some goods that are better secured or secured, necessarily by these prohibitions, by these rules. And so I'm skipping over some information here because, you know, I'm not going to give his whole lecture again. But to summarize, at the end, he basically reaches this idea that, like, ethics is a skill, not a science. That there is no math, no formula that you can apply to ethics to be an ethical person. But basically what an Aristotelian prohibition is an Aristotelian prohibition prohibits actions that virtuous agents never perform. So in any way that you go about defining that, it's basically to be a virtuous person, you need some character traits, and there are some things that you never do, that no virtuous agent ever does, and those are what we would call Aristotelian prohibitions. Maybe not absolute in the sense of Kant, where like a rational alien or an angel would also follow these ethical rules, but at least for human beings in our particular circumstances, there are some things that virtuous agents never do. And so that's basically where he takes it at the end here, that like you can't recognize these a priori necessarily. You can sort of deduce the right action from any given scenario and be a virtuous person by doing the right thing and also never doing the wrong thing, a list of which we could presumably define.
You mentioned three ways of maintaining virtue or striving for virtue, correct?
Like yeah,
three ways of accomplishing the strategy?
Yeah, yeah. So he talks about strategy one is the analytically vicious actions, the things mm-hmm. you can never do right by sort of reason. Yep. The second is securing goods. Mm-hmm. And then the third strategy is this sort of like empirical strategy of you gather information from the outside. You don't create these rules a priori necessarily, but you basically the idea here is that you look at virtuous agents mm-hmm. and you see what is common amongst all of them. And so as a psychologist or a sociologist or an ethicist, you could look at a bunch of people that we would say are good or virtuous people. What are the things that neither of them ever do? And those mm-hmm. are your absolute prohibitions, your Aristotelian prohibitions.
I would say that this is at least the third proposition is potentially dangerous. It kind of assumes that you can observe a group of people accurately for essentially most of the behaviors that you're questioning, which is not always possible. So there are certain, I think, behaviors and situations that you can't always observe people's behavior for. Even if you can, you might not have a large enough sample size to be able to say, okay, well, this is virtuous because none of these other people do this. I think that argument is potentially problematic because first question, how do you know what your sample size should be, what your group of virtuous people should be to determine what you shouldn't do? And then second, what if your situation is different from all of theirs? If that's the case, then, or if you were in some way different than the group, does that make you an inherently virtuous person? Are you essentially hopeless if you are somehow different from those people in the group? So I think there are some questions there for the third strategy.
I really like both of those objections. They're not ones I thought of before. In Jeremy's defense, I will be fair to Jeremy here because this is sort of the strategy that he focuses on. I'll specify that basically what he says here is that the agent is in a sense aware of and intentionally avoids, unlike Kantian prohibitions, I'll quote here, unlike Kantian prohibitions, which the agent is aware of and intentionally avoids because it would violate the categorical imperative, the Aristotelian virtuous agent doesn't need to know that some course of action is something virtuous agents would never do. The person is just trying to work out the best way for them to act in their situation. And we, the philosophers and psychologists and whatever, would spot a pattern. But you do have a point there because, first of all, how do you know you're observing correctly? I appreciate that objection. But also, then how do you, even if you find something that like, oh, all these people that we think are good sort of never do this one thing, what if you run into a situation where in the best possible world, that's what you do? Like you say, are you hopeless? Are you lost? That's a good, I really appreciate that. I hadn't thought of that.
This may seem like an incredibly esoteric example, but I'm going to use it anyway. In mathematics, there's a famous story of younger in the sense of lower in the organization. So there's this organization called the Cult of Pythagoras, and one of the younger disciples comes to him and says, "I've discovered that there is a number that cannot be represented by dividing one number over another." And this goes against one of the axioms that the Cult of Pythagoras believes. So this is essentially the discovery of the proof for that the square root of 2 is irrational. And so Pythagoras looks at this proof, analyzes it very carefully, and then throws the proof away and has the disciple thrown into the water where he drowns, because
ouch.
This proof is a threat to what he believes is the security of his group,
right,
and their longevity as an organization. They believe that numbers were essentially like the underlying reality of the world, and to say that there exists a number that cannot be written down, right, was to question the faith and the structure of the group. So, I mean, maybe a bit of a drastic situation, but I think you can think of a lot of historical examples where the most virtuous actors in a group, or the leadership of a group, just to put it that way, might not agree with something that might be correct, or something that you believe is correct in your situation might not be, it might be good to show the community, to correct the community. It might not be good for you. And Kant has several propositions like this, right, where if someone who is hostile towards you comes to your door, do you tell the truth or do you lie? If these types of situations. And Kant, of course, has a prohibition against never lying, but it seems like Reed would probably give some contextual wiggle room there. So
yeah.
Maybe there's a way you can get out of that by lying or by not quite telling the truth, but you don't have to necessarily tell the truth in those types of situations.
Yeah, right. Megan, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking we're almost at the halfway point, so I'll let you bring us to that point. I'll let you respond to Aaron, and then I'll jump in with what I'm going to do.
Well, all right, thank you, Tegan, for keeping us on time. And with that, you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find the show at tcps.podbean.com. That's the Canadian Philosophy Show, tcps.podbean.com. And we are just continuing our discussion here about Aristotelian prohibitions, a lecture that I heard by Jeremy Reed, who's a professor of philosophy. And we're discussing this relationship between rule following and especially sort of absolute rules or seemingly absolute rules and virtue ethics. The idea brought by Aristotle that someone is virtuous when they act in virtuous ways, according to a certain balance between kinds of action, the golden mean, and taking on certain character traits and certain feelings about action is how you become virtuous. So we've just been discussing some strategies of how Reed gets there and why that distinction is important, which is something I actually should get to next. So we're talking about all of this, but I think it's important to mention contextually why Reed thinks that this is important in the first place. Basically, he says that Aristotelian prohibitions help to define virtue ethics because virtue ethics is about action. Virtue ethics is about deliberation, in a sense, because we're talking about his perspective anyway, is that we are constantly having to reframe what are characteristics that we appreciate, actions that are good, actions that are wrong, depending on our context. And that deliberation and that aim for action through intention, like Tegan mentioned, is sort of at the heart of this here. And if there's a way for us to find a pattern of rules that we should never break, that sort of helps uphold this structure, because it gives us a kind of, those patterns already exist. And so to identify them is to give a sort of rigor to their existence and to help us to contextualize rules and action as we continue to develop as a culture, as a society, what have you. Now, I have my own gripes and thoughts about that, but to re-